Basically, I want to talk about something really kind of an elementary question. So, so I want to start with a group, which let's just say is finitely presented. Okay. So, and even to make this kind of explicit, say we've got generators x1 up to xn, and relations r1 up to rm. Okay.
Right.
A little darker. Let's see. There's a lot of reflection off of the.
Turn the freaking lights off.
It's kind of like from the Age of Sail or something. Everybody jumps up to man the blinds. How are we? Still pretty bad.
There are some free couches. So.
Yeah.
It doesn't really seem to work if I write harder with the chalk either, so right, that's about as hard as it gets, so. Is it better from here on?
Yeah.
So maybe I could just write from only from here on over? So okay, so we've got, up there isn't very good either, right? Okay. Okay, so I want to look at the function, which we'll call, let's pick an element in the free group generated by S, and also let's say constants delta and epsilon greater than zero, and I want to look at the following quantity, which will be the hyperlinear profile of delta, W, delta, and epsilon, okay, so. Okay, so this is just going to be the minimum across integers d, okay, such that there are unitaries u1 up to un, such that if I plug these unitaries into my relations, okay, I'm within epsilon of the identity, okay? And if I take my word W and plug in the unitaries, I am at least delta away from the identity, okay? And this matrix norm here is just the normalized Frobenius norm. Okay, so this is 1 over d trace a star a. Okay, and d here is the dimension of the matrices. I didn't say that yet. So in both cases, these are d by d matrices. Okay. Now, there's no guarantee that unitaries like this are going to exist. So if they don't, let's just say that this quantity is plus infinity. Okay, so in other words, just to repeat, the hyperlinear profile of W, delta, and epsilon is the minimum dimension D such that we can actually find unitaries that we can plug into our relations to get within epsilon of the identity, okay, while keeping W, delta away from the identity, or plus infinity if it doesn't exist. Okay, so the elementary question I'm kind of interested in, and that I want to explain, you know, why is this an interesting question, and also what do we know about it, is just, how fast does this hyperlinear profile grow as a function of epsilon when epsilon goes to 0. Okay. We can also ask this question in other norms, by the way. Towards the end of the talk, I'll explain a little bit why this is the norm that we're using here. But really, this is why we call it the. This is where we get the hyperlinear part of this question. And if we did it with other norms, we'd have other types of profiles here. We could ask the question for other norms as well. But yeah, so the first thing is, where does this question come from? So was there an advantage to starting here, or is this kind of about the same?
That panel is worse.
This panel's worse. This one, or this one seems okay, though.
To me, I don't. Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe I'll start here. Yeah, so where this question comes from is what we'd like to know is, when can we see a group G in its kind of finite dimensional models? So okay, so what do we mean by this? So a finite dimensional model would be something that behaves like G. Okay, it obeys all the same relations as, let's say, we have n matrices maybe, and it has to obey all the relations here. Okay, so in other words, we're just talking about a homomorphic image of the original group. Okay, so make a definition. A group G is residually finite dimensional if for every W and G not equal to the identity, okay, there is a homomorphism to a finite dimensional unitary group such that phi of W is not equal to the identity. Okay, so this is kind of, if a group is residually finite dimensional, we say, might be a good way to say, yes, we can see it in finite dimensional models. For every element in the group, we can see that it's non-trivial, if it is non-trivial. We can see that it's non-trivial in a finite dimensional representation of the group. So there are lots of examples of residually finite groups, okay? And there are also lots of examples of non-residually finite groups, and maybe that's the more interesting part. We can kind of think, if we think of like the first groups we learned, like permutation groups, they're already, they're linear groups. They sit inside finite dimensional matrices. So we know the answer to this question is yes. But there are these non-residually finite ones where we can't do this. So there are lots of examples of non-residually finite dimensional groups. Okay, and if we think about what this means, that means so there is W G, which is non-trivial inside the group, but phi W is equal to the identity for every homomorphism to finite dimensional unitaries. Okay, so here's an example. If I write down the Baumslag solitaire group 2, 3, okay, that's generated by just two generators. And the relation says that if I conjugate y squared, it has to go to y cubed. Okay, so let's see. So a representation of this would be two matrices which satisfy this relation, okay? And you can write down lots of finite dimensional representations of this, it turns out, okay? But there is an element It's a little long, but there's a word you can write down in terms of x and y such that it will always be trivial in finite dimensional matrices, but isn't actually trivial in this abstractly presented group.
Why do you demand limit yourself to unitary?
So for the exact question, you don't have to, right? But once I switch to what I'm about to switch to now, it does actually matter to say unitaries versus not. But in this case, actually, we could just say finite dimensional matrices like GLN, or we could just say finite groups if we wanted to. Theorem of Malchev says that it's all the same. Whether we want to separate in unitaries or GLN or in finite groups.
I think the double covering of SL4R is another example.
So I tend to know the discrete versions a lot better, but yeah, there are lots of examples out there of non-residually finite. In fact, you can do like a lattice with a central extension by a finite cyclic group and make that non-residually finite. Like there are, you know, turns out to be not very hard to actually make something non-residually finite. Yeah. So, but what I'm really interested in is not the exact version of this question of when can we see G in finite dimensional models, but the approximate version. So what if instead we ask about, say, approximate finite dimensional models? Okay. So we can try and kind of mimic what we just did. Okay. So we need to know what a representation is. Okay. So an epsilon representation of G is a homomorphism from, now this definition is only going to make sense for finitely presented groups. You could do it for non-finitely presented groups if you want, but it's a little easier just to work in this kind of more concrete setting. Okay, so this will be a homomorphism from the free group on the generators, okay, to the unitary group. And here now it actually matters that it should be the unitaries here. Okay. Such that if I look at what happens to the relations, right? So this is just a fancy way of saying that for every one of the generators, we assign a unitary matrix. And then if we plug those matrices into the relations, we should stay within epsilon of the identity. Okay, so that's that is an epsilon representation. Now, what does it mean to be, what does it mean to be, let's say, residually finite dimensional? What does it mean to be able to see an element being separated from the identity in an epsilon representation? Okay, well, we could just try and mimic this definition, okay, and replace homomorphism with epsilon homomorphism. And then maybe we want to say for all epsilon, there's an epsilon homomorphism with this property. The problem with that is that you can always make that work. And the reason is you can just jiggle the homomorphism a little bit, change the generator slightly, okay, and get that this thing is not equal to the identity. Okay? You'll move the epsilon up a little bit, okay, but not by too much. So what we actually need to do is rather than looking for homomorphisms where we're not equal to the identity, we need to be bounded away from the identity. Okay, so. So definition, so W in the free group generated by S is non-trivial in approximate representations of G. If there is a delta, such that for all epsilon there is an epsilon representation phi with phi of w greater than or equal to delta. Okay, so in other words, we can, for every epsilon, we can find an epsilon representation while keeping this particular word delta away from the identity. That's the idea. Okay, so we're bounded away in epsilon representations. So maybe a few notes about this definition. So one of them is it's not very hard to see that if W is non-trivial in approximate representations, then W is non-trivial in G. Okay. So notice that I made this definition for words rather than for group elements. We could make the definition for group elements if we want. All we'd have to say is that there is some word representing the group element, which is non-trivial in approximate representations. It turns out to be independent then of the word you would pick. Okay. But you might have to flip the, you might have to do something about the choice of delta here, or kind of the scaling of epsilon representations, right? It might not be a one-to-one correspondence between epsilon representations that allow you to do this, depending on the choice of word. The other thing is that the choice of delta, despite what I just said, having to move kind of deltas around and stuff like that, in the end, the choice of delta is arbitrary after you fix the word. So delta is arbitrary. Not completely arbitrary. We're dealing with unitary matrices, and the furthest a unitary matrix can be from the identity is 2, okay, which is achieved at minus the identity. Right, this normalized Frobenius norm is 1 on the identity. So, and actually, we can't hope to get up to 2. You know, we can't get close to minus the identity for every matrix. But what we can do is get close to root true. Okay, so it can be anything between 0 and root 2. And this type of thing, there are these kind of amplification tricks. So if you can do it with some delta, then you can amplify the delta and get it arbitrarily close to root 2.
Element such that there is a delta, such that for some word this delta is not zero, then there's some other word for the same group element where you can get delta arbitrary.
No, once you pick your word, then you can do the amplification. So pick your word first.
Oh, there's a representation where.
So if it's true with some delta, then it will be true with any delta in this range. So then you could go to, let's say it was true for delta equals a quarter. For your particular choice of W, then it would be true for delta equals a half as well.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And what would change is the scaling of the, so you wouldn't be able to use the same epsilon representations, okay? But you would be able to combine. This amplification is basically the tensor power trick. So you take tensor powers of representations.
So in this definition of residually finite. Why don't you just ask it to be a faithful representation? Is that too much?
You can't, yeah. So there are groups where that are residually finite, but they're nonlinear. So you can have a nonlinear residually finite group.
Meaning it doesn't, what does nonlinear mean?
Oh, meaning it doesn't have a faithful finite dimensional representation, exactly.
Yeah, I'm not claiming they're equal, but why do you focus on this? As opposed,
yeah, so why see the group in pieces versus seeing the group all at once? It's a good question. Like, I think they both are good answers to the original question. They're just, you know, kind of two flavors of the question. So you get different answers depending on what kind of flavor you pick, whether you want to see, you know, the whole group at once or do you care about individual words. I guess. Yeah, the argument for caring about individual words is that you're trying to, you know, you write down, I'm not a logician at all, but kind of like trying to think through that mindset. You write down a sentence in the group elements, right, an individual word, and then you want to know if that sentence is trivial or not. So you really care only about kind of individual words at one time, or collect some or finite sub collections of words, because you can take direct sums of representations, you know, for any finite set. You get the same if you allow finite collections of words. Oh, yeah, okay, so and then I can replace the definition I just erased with the version for the approximate thing. Okay, so we say G is hyperlinear if every, so I have to word this a bit awkwardly because of my choice to use words rather than group elements, okay, but it's really just the same thing. If every W in free S, which is non-trivial in G, is non-trivial in approximate representations. So I don't think that there is, like, I think for the exact case, you know, you do get these two flavors of the question, but I don't think you get the flavor of what does it mean to be linear, like have a faithful finite dimensional representation in the approximate case. Yeah, so kind of the whole point is that, well, we'll get to that, I guess. So it's probably clear if I want to look for examples here, RFD groups are hyperlinear, okay, so obviously. And then some non-RFD groups are hyperlinear as well, okay, and we can show that, like the example I gave of this BS23. This is hyperlinear.
Can you conclude anything about the growth of groups like this?
So.
And this is a standard like Pete's alternative for linear groups.
So there's two different types of, well, maybe more than two. But you mean the actual growth of the, like the number of elements over the.
Yeah,
we don't really know any relation between the growth and the. Well, I guess if the growth is polynomial or whatever, they're amenable. And that's a good one. Okay, so amenable groups are hyperlinear. Yeah, so we know lots of hyperlinear groups. Yeah. And then lots of things that are non-amenable even fit into here, right? The free group is linear, I guess, so. You know, yeah, it's not just that hyperlinear things are close to amenable either, not at all. There's lots of it's a big class. We don't know if there is a non-hyperlinear group. Okay, and so this is really the big question in the subject is there a non-hyperlinear group? Okay, so now to go back to the function I defined at the beginning, right? This was HLP W delta epsilon. Okay, so that was the minimum across D such that there is an epsilon representation of dimension D. Okay, with so an epsilon representation phi. Maybe instead of saying dimension D, I'll just write it down. It's phi going from the free group of S to the unitary group of dimension D. Okay, with phi of W minus identity at least delta away from the identity, right? Or plus infinity if no such representation exists. Okay, so we see where this function I wrote down at the beginning comes from. What we're talking about now is we're interested in is the growth rate of these, of the dimensions of epsilon representation satisfying this bounded away from the identity condition. So let's kind of think how this goes through. If we had a non-hyperlinear group, okay, so we don't know any examples of these, but if we did have one, that's equivalent to saying that there's some, we pick our delta, and then when epsilon gets small enough, there just is nothing in the set. There is no epsilon representation that we can choose. Okay, so maybe I'll take out the if here. G is non-hyperlinear if and only if there is W, W non-trivial in G such that this hyperlinear profile equals plus infinity as epsilon goes to 0. On the other hand, if we have a residually finite dimensional group, okay, then at some point we're going to be able to find an exact representation where we are delta away from the identity, okay? And so this will be bounded. As epsilon goes to 0. So not only is it finite, it stays bounded. And this is, again, for all W, which are actually non-trivial in G. OK, so the interesting case is, what if we have, the interesting case for this function, OK, is what if we have a hyperlinear but non-RF D group? OK, so turning this statement around, if this is true, that this is less than, let's say, D as epsilon goes to 0, then we can just take the limit of representations and find an exact representation. So there is an exact representation of dimension D such that phi of W is not equal to the identity. Okay, so W is one of the things we can actually see in kind of exact finite dimensional representations. Right? So if G is hyperlinear, but non-RFD, then there is an element W such that this function is finite. but it goes to plus infinity in the limit. So our starting question one more time. Is how fast can this function grow? Oh.
By the way, is this statement that every group is hyperlinear, is that the same as the Kahn conjecture or whatever?
Yeah, not quite, and that's exactly the next. Yeah, very, very well anticipated. Yeah. So, but that's exactly where the connection with Kahn comes in.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So let's see what let's see about that. Yeah. So a non-hyperlinear group would give a counterexample to the Kahn embedding. So I'm going to say, I guess, especially see how much time. Yeah, so we've got lots of time. So, so I'm going to explain a little bit about what this problem is, or maybe a lot. But so maybe just kind of to summarize the situation we're in. So the Kahn embedding problem is, you know, one of the major problems of functional analysis, and completely open. Okay. And the question about whether every group is hyperlinear is basically the question for group algebras. So it's a subset of the question. And if we could show there was a non-hyperlinear group, that would provide a counterexample to the problem. So the motivation for this question is we'd like to know if there's a non-hyperlinear group. We really have no idea how to. We can guess at some groups that might be non-hyperlinear, but we really have no idea whether they're good guesses or how to go about proving such a thing. So in the meantime, we need to look for easier questions. And I would say this is an easier question that we can ask. OK, we'd really like to know, are there groups where this hyperlinear profile is infinite? OK, we can't answer that question. So let's try and say, can we get some groups? You get to pick the group. You get to pick the group element. You get to pick the delta. And you want to pick them in such a way that you can make this thing grow to as fast as possible. And that is kind of our finite version of the Kahn embedding problem. Rather than having it jump right up to plus infinity, we just try and make it grow as fast as possible. So and where are we in that? Not very far. Maybe I'll tell you kind of at the end. So maybe the thing to do now is to say, why do we care so much about this Kahn embedding problem? Okay, so so part of the reason we care about this, so it started originally with Kahn, okay, and a question about classification of von Neumann algebras. And the question is roughly, I'm not going to word this exactly right, okay, but does every 2-1 factor embed in R omega, okay, and this is this R omega is an ultra power of the hyperfinite 2-1 factor. Okay, and you don't need to to understand these words to get the idea of what the flavor of this question is. Okay, so there's a classification of these algebras into different types. One of the types is 2-1. Okay, this is a particularly nice 2-1 algebra, the hyperfinite 2-1 factor. Okay, and so Kahn's question, which was not intended to be a big question, but more kind of a, heard it characterized as kind of a throwaway remark, okay, was just to say, so we've got this kind of unique hyperfinite 2-1 factor. If you take ultra powers of it, do all the other 2-1 factors embed into it? Okay, and so where this Kahn embedding problem really became kind of a big deal was not through this original formulation, I guess interesting enough as it is to people doing classification of von Neumann algebras, but really through many equivalent characterizations of the problem that were found. And that my understanding is that a lot of these are mainly due to Kirchberg. Okay, so really, actually to lots of people, I think, but maybe he kind of started the trend and really kind of made it into an important problem, even though it's got Kahn's name on it. So just to give you a kind of a another idea of the type of flavor of things that come up in this, one would be classification of tensor products of C-star algebras, which is something, you know, starting to get close to mathematical physics, okay? Because in quantum mechanics, we need a notion of tensor product, right? And for Hilbert spaces, there's just a unique tensor product. But it turns out for C-star algebras, you can define more than one possible tensor product. And there's a unique kind of maximal one, which has it's the algebra with the largest norm. Okay, and there's a unique minimal one. And so one way to formulate this question is to say if you take the C star group algebra of the free group on a finite set of generators, okay, and take its maximal tensor product with itself, is that the same thing? This is probably going to be hard to see. I apologize. Try and sneak it in here. Okay. So what this says is the same thing as what I just wrote here, but with min in there. Okay. So is the maximal tensor product the same thing as the minimal tensor product? Okay, so what I want to spend some time explaining is where I got interested in this problem, which is its connection to quantum mechanics and quantum probability. So there's an equivalent formulation of this I'm not sure if it's really fair to call it quantum mechanics, maybe better to say quantum probability. Okay, and that's through Bell inequalities and non-local games. Okay, so how does this formulation of the problem work? Okay, so it starts by thinking about axioms for quantum mechanics. So rather than jump right to quantum mechanics, let me just say axioms for physical systems. So what do we mean by, you know, what would an axiom set for physical systems mean? Well, it would depend on the type of physical systems they were trying to describe. But if we think about like what the axioms for quantum mechanics do, right, it should say things like how to describe the state of the system. Okay. Maybe how the system evolves in time and so on. I don't really care about that in this case. What I do care about is measurement. Okay, so it should describe what it means to measure a physical system and, you know, what happens in that measurement process. And most crucially for this connection with Kahn embedding, it should say how to what happens with subsystems. Okay, so what do I mean by this? So a lot of times when we're talking about physical systems, we have a situation where we have two physical systems, A and B, and we want to combine them and talk about the joint system given by both of these systems together without saying anything about how they interact, and say kind of under the implicit assumption, or sometimes explicit assumption, right, that they don't have any communication or that they're physically separated. Okay, so our axioms should tell us how to describe the joint system of two subsystems. That's something we kind of expect out of axioms for physical systems.
I could make a comment.
Uh-huh.
It's probably a diversion, but I can't help making it, which is, I mean, if you think of quantum field theory, I think you're already out of this framework.
No, actually, I'll tell you what in the algebraic quantum field theory, they actually explicitly have axioms to say this, but you have to be careful about how you word it. You may not want to say that there's an explicit way to combine, but it will tell you when you have a joint system with physically separated subsystems.
You won't be able to build up the whole field from these kind of systems.
That's absolutely right, exactly. And that distinction, so
furthermore, they're not at one time, if they're, you know, they're space-time regions.
Yeah, so take the most liberal interpretation when I say you want your physical systems to have. I don't literally mean that, for instance, we should only talk about axiom systems where you have to be able to build things up from subsystems, or that if you have two subsystems that you should be able to combine them. Perhaps you can only combine some subsystems and talk about, you know, perhaps there are only limited situations when you can talk about the joint system of a subsystem. I just mean that they should have some, we expect them to have some features like that in the theory, but they may be limited or have restrictions on them, or, you know, I don't mean to put any strong restraints on the type of axiom systems we should talk about.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, because space-time regions are already getting a little beyond this, but if you look at the measurement question, it turns out you can't observe the most so-called observables in the space-time, in an arbitrary space-time region. Plus causality.
Gotcha. That's probably, talking about that kind of thing is probably too far of a diversion.
Yeah,
for, but afterwards, maybe. Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, actually, there's a lot of stuff you can start saying when you start talking about all the kind of things that arise, but I want to get specifically to this connection with Kahn embedding, which means I need to actually put on, you know, I want to think about this kind of situation specifically and think about even a bunch more structure on there. So kind of imagine, okay, that we're in a situation with two labs. Okay, each subsystem here is a lab. Okay, and they have a physical system of their own. Okay, and they want to make measurements, each capable of making one up to M measurements. Okay. And each measurement returns one of one up to N outputs. Okay, so we're kind of abstracting away all the details of, you know, what the measurement maybe, we think of the measurement, maybe in the lab they're thinking of the measurement as returning some number, but there is some kind of cutoff, and so it becomes some rounding that's involved, and so we get just a discrete number of outcomes. Okay, so what I want to look at are the probabilities AB XY. So when I say we want to look at, so given a physical system where this is true, okay, we can look at these probabilities. So this makes sense given a physical system. Given such a system. And in particular, a set of axioms that allow us to talk about this kind of thing, but in the most liberal sense, not, they only have to be able to describe, well, they basically have to be able to describe how to calculate these probabilities given, say, a system in some state. So probability of outcome AB on input XY. So we're going to call this a collection of numbers. Okay, so there are, it's not a probability distribution. It's m squared probability distributions. Once we fix x and y, it's a probability distribution. Okay, so we've got n squared times m squared numbers. This is called a correlation. And so the question we can ask now, not about physical systems, but about axiom systems, is what correlations can we get from given axiom systems? So for instance, just to give kind of an idea of the flavor of this, if axioms are, let me use a very vague word, just in the interest of saving some time, if they're reasonable, then they should not allow signaling. Okay, so what that means is that we're really making an assumption that these two labs are making these measurements simultaneously. They're in physically separated locations. They're not allowed to send messages faster than the speed of light, and these measurements are happening more or less simultaneously. So they shouldn't be able to send messages using this kind of the correlations. And maybe what we mean by that really is to say that what Alice does in her lab, she shouldn't be able to see what measurement Bob has chosen to make or what outcome Bob has got from the results of her experiment. Okay, so we could say that if we look at the probability of A given X, okay, how would we define that? That would be the sum over B of, right, so each of Alice and Bob have chosen a measurement to make. Bob has maybe chosen Y, okay? Right, and so the probability that Alice gets A on her choice X would be the sum over the different outcomes for Bob given this choice Y. Right, but as written, this depends on Y. Okay, so we say that the correlation is non-signaling if this is well defined. Right, so is uh, is independent of y. For all a and x. And similarly, for the probability of b given y. Okay, so correlations satisfying this condition are called non-signaling correlations, right? So a reasonable thing would be to say, like, if we have a reasonable set of axiom systems, we should expect non-signaling correlations only. So that's the kind of flavor of questions we might ask about our correlation sets. In the interest of time, I'll skip the classical correlation sets, unless there are any major complaints. But I know a lot of people have probably heard the story. And if not, that's the easiest part to fill in. So let me skip to, so definition, a correlation P is quantum. Right, so now let's actually look at, rather than looking at abstract axiom systems, let's talk about quantum mechanics. So this is probably pretty familiar, right? So the state of the system should be a unit vector in a Hilbert space, right? Measurements are described by maybe projections or maybe generalized measurements, depending on exactly how we want to set it up. And subsystems, well, if we have a Hilbert space, a state in a, well, not a state here, but be careful. We have a Hilbert space for this physical subsystem. Okay. Oh, there's something in here which I should say maybe before subsystems, I should have written down as a bullet point, systems. Okay, so systems are Hilbert spaces, states are unit vectors, right? And subsystems combine by taking tensor products. So if we want the joint system, we take the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces for the two subsystems. And then what is a state of the joint system could be a vector in this tensor product. Okay. And so if we go down to say what could a correlation matrix be, well, we just need to write down kind of the quantum mechanics descriptions of this, right? So if there is pardon me, I'm going to kind of abbreviate this a little bit, right? So I'm not going to write down there are two Hilbert spaces, right? That's implicit here, HA and HB. There's a state in both of them. And there's collections of measurements, MXA, A in A going from 1 up to N, NYB, B going from 1 up to N. Okay, and there are M measurements on, so these all act on HA. And these all act on HB, all right? And so there are M measurements here and M measurements here, indexed by Y. And then we say such that the probability of getting A and B when we pick the X and Y measurements is this joint expectation, MXA tensor NYB. So let me remind you how Bell inequalities fit into this picture. Okay, so we have a set of classical correlations, M and N. Okay, and as just defined, we have a set of quantum. Correlations. Okay. And every classical correlation is a quantum correlation. And so these are both convex sets. All right, so if I want to draw some kind of idealized convex sets, they don't look like this at all, but let's draw them as a big convex blob. Okay, and inside, one is inside the other. Here's our C classical, and here's our C quantum. Okay, and then Bell's theorem says that there are quantum correlations which are not classical. And even better than that, we can actually find like a kind of a separating hyperplane. Okay, such that this is Fp equal to alpha. Okay, so if we plug in a correlation and we get greater than or equal to alpha, or strictly greater than alpha, then we're somewhere over here. We're a quantum correlation that's not in the classical correlation set. Right? And so this is the thing that's actually been done in an experiment, right? You can actually generate some of these correlations in a lab, plug them into this linear function, and see that the value is greater than this alpha, right? And then you say this correlation is actually not a classical correlation because it violates this Bell inequality. So we get experiments to show that there are non-classical correlations. Okay, so we're not at Kahn embedding yet. So how do we get to Kahn embedding? Well, it turns out that this is not the only way we might try and axiomatize subsystems in quantum mechanics. Okay, and it actually relates exactly to the problems you get in quantum field theory, although I'm not an expert enough to expound on exactly why that is the case. But apparently, for very good reasons, you do not want to use this in quantum field theory, right? So instead, what do you do? So commuting operators. So instead, what you say is that there are, rather than systems being described by Hilbert spaces, let's say that systems correspond to algebras. Okay, C star algebras maybe. Okay, really subalgebras of some bounded operators on Hilbert space. So if we go back to kind of our picture that we just erased, we've got this big system. Maybe that's the algebra of bounded operators on some Hilbert space. Okay, but we want to talk about subsystems, so maybe each subsystem actually is just a subalgebra of this larger algebra. Okay, so A and B just kind of sit inside. Unfortunately, I do this every time I give this talk, and I never learn my lesson. Not the same B here, OK? Just some algebra sitting inside here, OK? And then what does it mean for them to be physically separated in this context? Well, a pretty good definition is to say that A and B must commute. And that's exactly the axioms that are used for something like algebraic quantum field theory. OK, so let's change this to use commuting operators instead. Is a commuting operator correlation if So there is, we still need a state inside a Hilbert space, okay? And we still need these measurement operators. Now there's no Hilbert space for them to act on, like no subspace for them to act on. Instead, they're just going to act on H. Oops. Okay, and we replace that requirement that they act on these different Hilbert spaces by saying that they have to commute for every A and B. So they belong to commuting subalgebras. Okay, and then with PAB, XY equal to so our joint expectation, this doesn't, if you're used to the other axiom, it doesn't quite look right to just multiply, but as long as they're commuting, then that's fine. Still acts like a measurement operator. Okay. So just like we get a set of, so maybe let's leave up these two definitions and go back to this picture. Okay, so we've got quantum correlations. And now we can talk about C commuting operator. Okay, and these are both convex sets again.
You keep saying that convex, if you want them to be convex, don't you need to use density, allow density matrices in your states as well as pure states?
Not actually, because you can just take the GNS purification.
Oh.
Yeah. So the only place where you need to worry about convexity is in the classical correlations, where if you write down that too quickly, you can forget about shared randomness. But all these other ones tend to be fairly robust because you can either hide the convexity somewhere in the measurements or by doing some purification procedure. And in fact, so you can go so far as to make sure that not only do you have a pure state, you can make them projective measurements by doing dilation as well.
Because you're not really demanding, well, something. You're not looking at all possible correlations within that. You're fixing first a set of correlations and then allowing yourself to choose the Hilbert space, I guess.
Right. Maybe the way to say it is that I'm thinking about axiom systems which allow you to take GNS representations. If you were to look at axiom systems where...
I mean, they wouldn't be irreducible then, so you might not be so happy with them, but...
Yeah, so right. So the irreducible ones are the extreme points, right? Well, not necessarily, but I mean, that's kind of intuitively... What we kind of expect, yeah.
If you were just dealing with qubits or something, then.
Pardon?
If you were just dealing with qubits or something.
Yes, absolutely. If you fix the dimension.
If you fix them, then you'd want to allow.
I think even you may be in trouble there. Even allowing density matrices, you're probably not going to be convex.
Oh.
So,
not really?
I don't think so.
Can't you just take the convex?
So they're not necessarily going to be how do you do non-orthogonal? Well, maybe that's not worth worrying about too much.
Yeah.
But, yeah. There doesn't really seem to be a good theory of with fixed dimension that really makes the correlation sets look nice. It's a quadratic problem, right? So we have two convex sets. And it's clear that the quantum correlations are contained in this commuting operator one, because these tensor product operators are going to commute with each other. So what we'd like to know is, are we in the same situation as we had for quantum versus classical? Are there Bell inequalities in the situation? So question, are there Bell inequalities? Okay, and maybe it's worth noting we can show that these two sets are different. Okay, so we know that there is a correlation, which is a commuting operator correlation, which is not in this quantum correlation set. But that's not the question we ask when we ask, are there Bell inequalities? We're asking, is there a correlation which can be separated by a hyperplane? And the answer for that is, you can separate a point from a convex set by a hyperplane if it's not in its closure, right? So as long as you have a closed convex set, you can separate every point outside it using a hyperplane. Okay. So what we want to know is, this question is this set of commuting operator correlations equal to the closure of this set of quantum correlations? And it turns out this closure you can show is actually equal to the closure of finite dimensional quantum correlations. Okay, so that's kind of a very natural set to think about. We might think about these the finite dimensional ones as ones that maybe we can actually realize, although if the dimension is too large, that's probably not true, right? But then the things in the closure are kind of idealizations of those finite dimensional ones. So are all of those commuting operator, vice versa, is every commuting operator one of these? Okay, so so this question is equivalent to the Kahn embedding problem.
What's an example of something that's that you have there that might be in the closure but is not in CQ or whatever?
Not so easy to say. Something here. Sorry, you mean something? Yeah. Not so easy to say. So, what? I can answer that question, but maybe.
Okay.
I know I just looked at the time and I noticed we went a little bit over. I mean, we started a little bit late, but I don't want to drag this on forever. The only thing I didn't mention, which should come in my talk, is 30 seconds of saying why entanglement is in the title. So, if you'll put up with me for 30 more seconds, say if. We did have, so if Kahn embedding was false, that would mean we have a point here we can separate by a Bell inequality. That can only happen in infinite dimensional spaces. Okay, so if you did have such a situation, we wouldn't actually expect to be able to do this, but it would mean that like you could imagine, at least do the thought experiment of an experiment that would demonstrate that the Hilbert space of the universe is infinite dimensional, which we don't think is true, to emphasize. Okay, but you could imagine doing. A mathematician could imagine doing the experiment, having no, responsibility for how to translate that into actual fact. Okay, so the entanglement's in here because if we think about this hyperlinear profile and the growth rates of these groups, which I say is this kind of finite version of Kahn embedding, we can think about that as a resource problem. Can we write down Bell inequalities where violating them would demonstrate that the Hilbert space has to be a certain dimension? And then we can actually write these down where the dimension is kind of going up to infinity. So you can show that in quantum mechanics, you're supposed to be able to get up to 1. And as you get closer and closer, the dimension has to go higher and higher. And so what is that growth rate? You can relate that to this hyperlinear profile. So that's the where the entanglement comes from. And what are the best growth rates we have so far? On the archive, you can find some stuff which is polynomial, like 1 over epsilon to 1 over epsilon squared might be the best. Due to Tschifra, Glevsky, Lubotsky, and Tom, okay? And if we had another 20 minutes, I could tell you about how to do it with kind of a sub-exponential growth rate here. It's kind of the best we can do so far. So I'll stop there. But now I'm happy to stick around and, answer whatever more open-ended questions.
Maybe a general question is also, why are they the same? I mean, why is the Kahn embedding problem the same as this
Yeah, so they.
Is it supposed to be obvious now that you've defined?
No, not at all. I don't think so. I mean, it took. So the original problem goes back to the 70s, late 70s, right? And people have kind of added to the collection of equivalent problems over the years. And this one, the equivalence between the two, let's give that an attribution to somebody, was proven by Ozawa. And I want to say, well, forget the exact year that came out, but maybe 2012, something like that. So not too long ago. But the credit for noticing this is actually due to two groups of people: Tobias Fritz, who was just here, just left. If you got a chance to talk to him, he was here. And the other group is Larch. So I'm going to mess up. So Younga, Vasquez, Elzuelos, Perez Garcia, Schultz, and Werner. Yes. Volker Schultz and Reinhard Werner, yes. I think I got everybody in there, I hope. So around the same time, they basically noticed this equivalence. And they couldn't quite prove this exactly. So they proved a kind of a matrix version of the problem was equivalent to Kahn embedding. And then Ozawa figured out how to close the gap.
Are there more questions for Will?
So I was just curious because, somehow one of these things where I had thoughts during the talk where when you were then like, well, this is equivalent to a really well-known open problem that lots of people thought about. I was like, that thought was probably really dumb. Uh-huh. For example, this point about the like Tietz alternative. I mean, if something that simple were true, presumably you would know that there were non-hyperlinear groups because they're groups with intermediate growth.
Yes, right. We don't know.
Full sort of wondered, like, what would happen? Like, have you thought about groups with intermediate growth as like candidate counterexamples? These like very strange automatic groups, right? Like, it's a lot of work to construct a group with intermediate growth.
So I have to think about it a little bit. I have thought about it a little bit.
But sort of, that's one where there's kind of some sort of really bad incompatibility with being linear, right? Like,
I expect the experts have thought about it much more than I have.
I'm sure. Yeah, well, exactly. Right. Like, presumably somebody else had that thought a while back.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to know what happened when they had that thought.
So the groups of how does this work again? They're non-amenable groups, right? Or are they?
Yeah.
So I just don't know. I met Grigorchuk basically at Texas A&M,
right.
And around that time I thought about it for 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember coming to any kind of conclusion. So,
okay.
Yeah.
You have this set for these two sets are defined for every M and N. So,
yeah. So the
when this is the statement that there is the statement that the two sets are not equal. Is that the statement there exists a particular M and a particular N for which they're not equal?
Exactly. Yeah.
But we don't, no one knows how big this M and N is.
So this statement would be non-equal.
Yeah.
We can actually, so we didn't know this until a couple years ago and managed to get some so the number of outputs, that's not hard to control. So that would need to be, which one was which? The M was the number of inputs. I think N was the number of outputs. Okay, so that one was only about 8. And really, if you wanted, you could probably get that down to two just binary outputs. That's not so bad. But we had this kind of in the hundreds, but specific examples. But then over the last year, Vern Paulson and his student Jitendra Kesh and Ken Dykema.
One is settings and one is outputs.
Yeah, right. So
which one is which?
This one, let's say, is outputs. Okay. I don't remember which one is which either.
And the other ones is
settings. Yeah, so we had this in the hundreds and this eight. And now they've got it down to a very nice example, five and two. So, and we think it should be true for three and two, I'll say. There's an example going back a while now called the I-3322 inequality or game where we think that it should separate these sets, but nobody knows how to prove it for that one. Yeah. And in fact, it may not even be. It's numerical evidence for it, so which is basically a search through a limited set of possible matrices. Doesn't reveal any kind of exact representation going up to maybe 100 dimensions. Oh, it's roughly like a numerical search through a subset of call these things strategies for the correlation. Or maybe let's call them models of the implement. So a search through a restricted set of models up to about dimensions in the hundreds, let's say. That's my understanding of the numerical work. I'm probably a little off. I haven't checked.
It's five and two is a rigorous.
That's a rigorous proof, yep. Yeah, it uses a really kind of interesting. So the original thing we had in the hundreds here came through thinking about this group theory stuff, but the getting it down to just five settings uses a really nice result about which what it is I forget so. This result here is Vern Paulson and student and Ken Dykema. But they used a result by somebody who, I know I can't remember their name, which was asking the question of when can you have a collection of projections that sum to a scalar multiple of the identity inside a C star algebra. So of course, for this to be true in finite dimensions, let's see, this has to be an integer. Is that right? Take the trace. So the trace of a projection is always a, maybe I should say it has to be a rational number from that argument. Okay, so the question is, in what dimensions, what numbers can you get? And then in other, you know, types of C-star algebras, you can actually get non-rational numbers there. They leverage this result to get a proof in correlations. Five settings that can't be realized in finite dimensional limit spaces. Yeah. Which is maybe not quite the same as what I defined here.
But, finite, but
yeah. I think
you allow infinite on both.
Yeah. So the group theory one I mentioned is fine with infinite here as well. But actually, all of a sudden, I don't remember. I think Vern told me that they also get in the end that that it does extend when you have infinite tensor infinite. But you'd want to, if you don't rely on that result, double check that if you wanted
okay.
to use it. It might just be finite. Yeah. So it turns out that the expressive power of the infinite tensor infinite is not very much more than, well, in the closure, it's exactly the same thing as, you know, they have the same closures as finite tensor finite. But in a lot of cases, the power of the infinite tensor infinite is not much more than the finite tensor finite. So it wouldn't be too surprising, I think, if they actually got the correlation, the separation with, infinite tensor infinite.
Except that if it's just in the closure, you could easily see that the limit, you easily think that the limit of the finite dimensional tensor product could be the infinite dimension. Maybe one shouldn't think like that, but it's. That's how I would think naively.
Well, right, and it's interesting that it's not always the case, right? That you can get things that are in the... Oh, hold on, is this right? Yeah, you can get... No. Yes, that's right. This is true. So you can get things that are... so we tend to break out, actually, this this one for finite dimensional and add on an S for infinite tensor product, okay? And you can get something which is in the limit of the finite dimensional ones, which is these two things have the same closure. So you can get these two separated. So things that are in the limit of finite dimensional things, but not expressible with infinite dimensional tensor products. No. Yeah, so there is something that can be...
But I think it's the other way that's relevant. I mean, suppose it is in the infinite. Is it then in the limit of the finites?
Here, the equivalence of these two. Yeah, it turns out it is. And you have to be a little careful with this, but I think it's all right to start thinking about it by saying you can imagine, if it's in the limit of these things, you can imagine truncating the state. So it has a Schmidt decomposition, and then imagine cutting that off at some point. You have to be careful because then you're still applying these, and these might not generate a... but I think that idea, if you run into problems with that idea, at least it's in the right direction. Well, that's true.
Can you say what kind of algebras it is that gives this counterexample?
Sorry, that's just, maybe we should try to formally bring it to a close and keep discussing.
Sure, that's fine with me, yeah.
Just to think a little bit.
Yep.